We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover this morning, starting with local and our very own Mayor Mike McGinn.
Yes, he made a couple of announcements this week, a couple that were quite controversial. And this is as a lead up to his release of his budget plan next week. He's starting to kind of get people ready for some of the changes in the budget that he's proposing. And this week he proposed combining the departments of housing, the Department of Housing with the Department of Economic Development. And he said this will save the city about $338,000. In early 2010, the director of the housing department left the department, and McGinn has delayed naming a new permanent replacement. But and folks then were speculating, well, the reason he's delaying is because he wants to merge it with another department. And there was some discussion then of merging it with the Department of Economic Development. But that's puzzling to me because the two seem to have contrasting conflicting goals there. The Department of Economic Development is basically geared towards what you would think of as urban renewal projects to upscale neighborhoods, whereas the Department of Housing's goal should be to ensure that all the residents of the city of Seattle have access to affordable housing. And I don't think those two goals sync very well.
I'm biting my tongue. I'm biting my tongue. I'm working for a city council candidate, and I might get in trouble if I say the wrong thing here.
And to be fair, the City Council Housing Committee members are not happy with this idea either. Nick Licata, the chair of the City Council Housing Committee, said that he didn't understand why his initial reaction is that he wasn't for merging the two departments. And the other two members of the committee, Sally Clark and Tom Rasmussen, have also voiced some skepticism about the plan. What I want to say is that I think as a standalone agency, the Department of Housing can serve the residents of Seattle much better than it can as a subdivision of another department. However,
And notice that you're assuming there that the housing folks would be in the subordinate role.
Yeah, exactly. And they will be if they're merged into another department with a different title. They will be a subdivision and it will be a subordinate role. And so some people have been asking, why don't you merge the Department of Housing with the Department of Human Services? That would make a lot more sense if you want to save money. And although it would have a subordinate role, at least it would be paired with a department that has a similar goal, not a conflicting one. We'll find out final details of McGinn's proposal next week when he announces his budget proposal. He made a couple of other announcements this week. One is that he'd like to redirect some funds from existing projects to projects in the parks, for parks, community centers, and transportation. Those details, again, will come with his budget proposal next week. But among them, he said this week that he wants to shift $1.8 million that was set aside for a permanent homeless encampment in Lake City in order to re-roof several community centers and other city-owned buildings. Now, those buildings do need work on them, particularly the older buildings like at CAMP, the Central Area Motivational Program, the Central Area Senior Center, the Southeast Health Clinic, etc. But it's unfair to pit them against money that's needed for a permanent homeless encampment. Both of those groups need the money. And as we heard from McGinn this week, there are other sources out there. The city just finished selling a vacant piece of land that generated $20 million, the rubble yard. That money is going to be used for things like parks and transportation infrastructure. But that money is also, McGinn also said that he wants to use that money for a couple of other purposes that I think are more suspect. One of them is he wants to put some money to the Mercer West beautification project. And he wants to put some money towards, quote-unquote, high-capacity transit with no details of what that high-capacity transit means.
Bike lanes.
No. It could mean bike lanes, but I'm guessing it probably means streetcars, in which case I think...
In which case we'd be better off with bike lanes.
Yes, we would be better off with bike lanes. And I think that they could take some money from that project and use it to re-roof the community centers.
Moving on, the Seattle Police Department and lawsuits.
Yeah, there were a couple of lawsuits There are, well, probably more than a couple of lawsuits going against the Seattle Police Department, but there's a couple that I want to talk about this week. In the case Evan Sargent versus the Seattle Police Department, Sargent claimed that he was assaulted by an off-duty police officer. Well, a lower court had awarded him, had ruled that the Seattle Police Department had repeatedly denied him access to documents that he should have had access to through the state's Public Disclosure Act. And the lower court fined the Seattle Police Department $70,000. Well, this week, an appeals court overturned the fine and sent the case back to King County Trial Court. They ordered the Seattle Police Department to explain why they withheld the documents, and the appeals court, although it upheld the ruling that the SPD violated the Public Disclosure Act, they threw out the fine, saying that it was excessive and that the violations were not intentional, even though they were repeated. So I have trouble understanding how you can repeatedly violate a law and it not be intentional, especially when you're a well-funded public agency like the Seattle Police Department that is supposed to know about the law.
Well, they have their own lawyers. I mean,
yes, they do.
That specialize in things like this.
Yes, they do. The other case that I want to talk about is Como filed a lawsuit this week against the Seattle Police Department for withholding the database of dash cam videos. After each shift, police officers have to transfer their dash cam video into the SPD computer system, and then it gets logged into a database. Well, Como wants access to the database, just the list of the dash cam videos that are stored in the system, so that they can file detailed public records requests for specific video footage. Otherwise, they have no idea what to request. The SPD has repeatedly denied access to that list. Como is particularly concerned because some private citizens have approached them, telling them that when they requested the dash cam videos from their own arrests, they were told by the SPD that those videos had been destroyed, even though their lawyers were able to get copies of those videos, and Como was able to get copies of those videos later. So Como is concerned that the SPD is not only withholding these videos from people who may have been the victims of assault during their arrest or of questionable arrests, they may also be lying about them. And so Como wants to forestall this problem by getting a list or having access to the database that lists the videos. And so they are taking the SPD to court, and we'll see how that progresses.
All right. Moving on, the Tacoma teacher strike, an update.
Yeah, the Tacoma teacher strike is settled as of this week, as of I think yesterday, or Thursday night anyway, and they won. It's actually very good news for people, those of us who are supporters of the beleaguered and much maligned labor movement. For folks who hadn't been following the Tacoma teacher strike, basically the school district administration and the Tacoma school board have opposed increasing class sizes, cutting teacher pay, and implementing subjective and potentially discriminatory policies on teacher staffing decisions. 87% of Tacoma teachers agreed to strike rather than concede on those issues, and they won on all of those issues. The class sizes and the settlement they reached will remain the same. There'll be some sort of a commission that will look at changing policies on teacher staffing decisions over the next year rather than the unilateral changes that the school district wanted to make, and so forth. So the lesson from this, which is not a lesson that you will readily read in the pages of the Seattle Times, is that labor solidarity works, that the Tacoma teachers got better pay and better working conditions and better class sizes and better education for their students than they would have had they not taken collective action.
Yes, and these things that they were asking for were not big things. I mean, they weren't asking for a huge raise. They weren't asking for things that were going to cost the district a lot of money. They're things that impact the educational quality in the classroom, particularly the class size issue. As someone who went to a school that had enormous class sizes, and where pretty much the bigger the class was, the more of a joke the lessons were.
And you never really recovered from that.
No, I think what helped me was having parents who were heavily involved in my education at home. Not every kid has that. In fact, I'd say most kids don't have that. And so it's very, very important to address these class size issues.
All right. Moving on to our Washington state issues. Percolating.
Yeah, there were a few state issues this week that I'd like to briefly talk about. Governor Gregoire called a 30-day special session this week. The 30-day special session starts in November 28th to tackle the $2 billion hole in the state budget. So the state legislature will have to convene a couple of months early to try to sit down and hammer out how they're going to close that hole. Also this week, anytime you turned on your TV or your radio, you got inundated with ads for and against I-1183, which is the liquor privatization bill.
It's not going to go away until November 8th.
It is not. Those are going to continue coming.
They're going to get worse, actually.
Yeah. Well, this week, a poll by a group called Strategies 360 showed that these ads are not helping I-1183 much. In the Elway poll in August, 50% of Washington residents were for privatizing liquor and 38% were against. Well, in the recent Strategies 360 poll, only 51 support I-1183, so it has gained one percentage point, and 44 are against. So the anti-liquor privatization group has gained something like 6 percentage points, probably because of the inundation of all these TV and radio ads.
Yeah. However, as long as they've got 50, that's all they need.
Yeah, that's all they need. So we'll see when, as we get closer to the election, if people start to really turn against them. Now, also this week, the state Democrats voted to support I-502. That's the initiative to legalize marijuana in Washington state. It would also tax and regulate the purchase and possession for adults over 21, and it would establish a legal intoxication limit similar to what the state does for alcohol. I-502 is the initiative sponsored by the ACLU of Washington and endorsed by former U.S. Attorney John McKay, Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes, and by Rick Steves, travel guru. So it's interesting to see the state Democratic Party come out and say, yes, we're for this initiative. That's going to give it legs, I think.
Yeah, although the Democrats did come out and support, not this year, but last year, the 2010 Sensible Washington Initiative also.
Yes.
This is not the first time they supported they've supported a decriminalization bill. And it should also be noted that within the legalization community, there's quite a bit of controversy over this initiative because of its stipulation of legal intoxication limits, because the science around that is not nearly as clear-cut as it is for alcohol.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on the Washington state issue?
Although, you know, intoxication limits can be changed, as they have been for alcohol throughout the years. So that could be a work in progress.
Yeah, well, that almost always is for new initiatives like this.
Yes, it is. I'm done.
Okay. Moving on, Amazon.
No, you're not.
Done with the state stuff.
Amazon getting some criticism. But not in our local papers.
No. The Seattle Times won't be picking this up. This is an investigative piece that was done in the Allentown, Pennsylvania Morning Call. And for those who want to take a look at it, we have the link up at eatthestate.org. It's an investigative story on the sweatshop in Breenigsville, Pennsylvania, outside Allentown, the warehouse that Amazon uses on the East Coast for distribution of the items that are shipped through it, and describes a situation in which summer temperatures of well over 100 degrees happen in the warehouse. People are having physical problems because of that. It's backbreaking labor. People are sped up and forced to adhere to unrealistic production goals. And Amazon uses almost entirely temps. It's very difficult to get a full-time job there. Obviously, it's not union. Obviously, there are no benefits. It really reads like something out of Fujian province in China or Madras or someplace like that in India, not someplace in the United States. And it raises a couple of obvious questions. Number one, this is what happens when you don't have unions in a factory job in the United States. And number two, where are the regulators on this?
Where's not, OSHA?
Yeah, where not all factory jobs in the United States or even in right-to-work states like the southern U.S., they're not all like this. And retailers are not all like this. Powell's generally, which is a union shop, has much better conditions if you really want to buy books or other trinkets online. But again, you won't be hearing a whole lot about this in local media because we don't do criticism of beloved local corporate giants.
Moving on to national and President Obama and a plan for the debt.
Yeah, he announced his debt reduction plan this week, and there were a lot of different aspects of it, but there are two aspects of it that I want to talk about. First, this whole controversy over taxing the rich. I just want to give folks some numbers to help you understand how taxes work in the U.S. these days. There are six marginal tax rates. The lower end is 10%. Then the two middle class rates are considered 15% and 25%. And then you have the upper middle class rate of 28% and 33%. And then you have what rich people pay or are supposed to pay, which is 35%. But of course, that applies only to what's called ordinary income. And ordinary income can be several different things, but typically and most often it is wages and business income from, say, for example, a Schedule C, where you're the sole proprietor of a business, you'd pay the 35% rate. A lot of people who make maybe, you know, take home maybe, $500,000 to $1 million or $2 million a year think of themselves as rich, and they pay the 35% rate because they have a lot of business income from their Schedule C or from their sole proprietorship or a lot of wages from their high paying job. However, they are not rich in America these
days. Not anymore.
Not anymore. No, no. They are upper middle class people. And it's shocking to me to think that someone who can take home almost $2 million a year is upper middle class. But that's because in the United States these days, there are a large number of people who are what I consider the filthy rich, people who take home tens or hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Now, the filthy rich don't tend to have wage income at all, or if they do, it's only a very tiny percent of their income. Instead, their income is mostly what you would call investment income. It comes from dividends, capital gains, and something called carried interest. Carried interest is compensation that's paid to hedge fund and investment managers. And all of that stuff is taxed at the 15% rate. And remember what I said, the 15% rate is the lower bracket for the middle class. So someone who takes home hundreds of millions of dollars, like Warren Buffett, for example, he may pay 15% or only a little bit over 15% because most of his income is in the form of carried interest and dividends, maybe some capital gains on stock options because he's an investment manager. And so you might want to ask, who is in the middle class these days? Well, the middle class in the United States is becoming a minority. Nearly half of all Americans, this is a statistic you should remember whenever you argue this point with anyone, nearly half of all Americans pay no taxes at all because their incomes are too low. What does that tell you? That tells you that U.S. income disparity is approaching third world levels. And I think that it's great that Job talked about the conditions at the Amazon factory, because that's the wave of the future unless Americans start to organize and demand, particularly Americans on the lower income levels, demand better wages and better working conditions. Now, the fact that the filthy rich aren't paying enough tax is only a small part of the problem. The bigger problem is that there simply aren't enough middle-class people to support the infrastructure that our parents and our grandparents built and were able to support because they made a middle-class wage. So the bigger problem is that the filthy rich, the extremely rich, actually exist in this country, and that obviously they exist at the expense of the rest of us. And so, of course, the solution to the debt problem and the solution to the jobs problem and the solution to the problems we've had in the economy is that we need income redistribution. And, of course, Obama's proposals don't really do that.
Yeah. To clarify, we've been having income redistribution for the last 30 years. That's why we've got this enormous disparity
in the wrong direction
between the filthy rich and the rest of us. What we need is to reverse that income redistribution.
Yes, yes. And the other aspect of the Obama debt plan that I want to talk about is the cuts that are being that he's proposed, some $248 billion in projected growth for Medicare and Medicaid. And they really fall into this problem of income redistribution, because the $248 billion wouldn't all go to help balance the budget and close the debt hole. No, much of the savings would go to pay doctors so that they wouldn't have to take cuts in the fees they charge Medicare patients. So here you have, you're forcing Medicare and Medicaid patients to pay higher copays and pay more out of pocket for their health care. And the money's going into the pockets of doctors so they don't have to reduce their fees. That's income redistribution in the wrong direction. And that's why the Obama debt plan is not a good one.
All right. Moving on. Developments this week, touching on Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes, the 7th U.S. District Court of Appeals, that's in Ohio, ruled that two American citizens who were detained and tortured without trial in Iraq under the Bush Defense Department can sue former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld because he had personally signed off on many of the techniques that were used against them. And those are some of, the classic techniques of constant light, sleep deprivation, stress positions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that were uncovered in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And some of these other things. They were used in this case on two whistleblowers in Iraq, defense contractors who tried to bring corruption to light and for their troubles were arrested by the Army and kept incommunicado and tortured for as I believe terrorist sympathizers for several months. This is a win for accountability. It certainly won't land Rumsfeld or any of his cronies in jail, which is where they probably should have gone, but it will certainly put some teeth into financial accountability for some of the crimes that were committed under George Bush.
All right. Moving on to international and European financial crisis.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about the crisis, and it's called the Eurozone crisis now. It's really the financial crisis in Europe, particularly the sovereign debt problem and the fact that European banks are heavily invested in sovereign debt or the debts that that European countries owe. And there's a lot of talk back and forth about what should be done to solve the Eurozone crisis. What it's come down to is two competing solutions, which really neither of them are good solutions. One is the one that is being mostly discussed right now and is being partially followed, is called the austerity and controlled default solution. Austerity meaning that the workers and the taxpayers in a country have to pay for the debt problem.
Oh, we know what it means.
Yes, and we probably know what that means, the austerity measures that are being passed by Greece and other governments. And it is most governments in the Eurozone that are passing these austerity measures now. Plus controlled default. And what controlled default means is it means private investors will have to take a loss on their investments, but not the big banks. So that means private investors like, mom and pop Jones who own a couple of bonds in their portfolio that happen to be from Europe, they will take something like 60 to 80 cents on the dollar of loss, while the big European banks will get paid almost full value.
Funny how the banks always come out okay in these situations.
Well, it's because there's this fear that European banks may fail and that could bring down the whole system. So that's the one that's being pursued right now. Now, the other alternative that is being proposed is euro bonds plus fiscal unity. Now, a lot of people are excited about the idea that that the Eurozone could get together and not just unite as a political entity and not just use a common currency, but to unite fiscally and to have a central bank that has a lot of power. There is a central bank in Europe, but it doesn't have a whole lot of power or a whole lot of funding. And that they could issue euro bonds, which would allow the whole zone and the central bank to borrow lots of money on the international market and use that to pay off the debts. Well, the problem is that means richer nations will pay for the poorer nations, meaning that Germany and France and the UK will end up supporting nations like Greece and Spain and Italy, the nations that were not responsible in their borrowing. And that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. But it also means more lending, more borrowing. And that really can't happen because the whole financial crisis all around the world is based on the problem that everyone has borrowed too much and everyone needs to buckle down and pay off their bills. So that whole discussion of what about Eurobonds and what about fiscal unity, will that save us? Well, no. It's not a good solution, and I don't see it coming in the future. But I also find it kind of depressing that the debate is between that and austerity plus controlled default.
All right, Turkey.
Turkey, yeah. This week, the foreign minister of Turkey gave an interview in which he said some things that I found very, very interesting and very revealing about what's going on in the Middle East. He said that Turkey is essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, Turkey is essentially turning away from its position that it's had for more than 50 years of aligning itself with Europe and seeing itself as culturally related to the West. And it's turning more towards alignment with the Middle East, particularly the democratic government in Cairo. Just in the last couple of weeks, the Turkish foreign minister paid a visit to Egypt, and he took with him a large number of Turkish businessmen, and they signed billions of dollars worth of deals with the new government and with businesses in Cairo. And so Turkey is seeing itself as a major player in an axis of democratic governments that will have the strongest influence in the Middle East. And that that axis will include Turkey, Egypt, the new democratic government of Libya, the new democratic government of Tunisia, and hopefully for the future, the new democratic governments of Syria, Jordan, and perhaps other countries. What it means is that the U.S. will have much less influence, having lost one of its most reliable partners in the Middle East, and that Israel also has lost one of its most reliable partners.
In Palestine.
Yeah. As folks know, Palestine went to the United Nations this week to petition for statehood. Well, late last night, President Obama announced that the U.S. and the so-called quartet will be restarting the Israel-Palestine peace process. The U.S., of course, has been scrambling in recent weeks to avoid an awkward situation in which it will bail out its best buddy Israel by vetoing at the U.N. Security Council level Palestine's application for statehood. Instead, that application has been put on hold while the quartet restarts the peace process. Now, this is something we've heard many times before, where the U.S. as the mediator in this conflict tries to bring the two sides to the table. Israel winds up coming to the table with either not coming to the table because they set impossible preconditions, or coming to the table with a proposal designed to fail that would not result in Palestine being truly politically or economically independent. And this may well be what happens again, but it really underscores this would not have happened at all had Palestine not taken the unilateral step to go to the United Nations. And it really underscores what Maria was just talking about in terms of the emerging democratic axis in the Middle East with Turkey and Egypt and some of these other countries, that they would really make more sensible mediators in a Middle Eastern conflict than the United States, which by virtually every party outside the halls of power in Israel is not seen as an independent mediator in that conflict.
And they would be much more credible, I think.
Yes.
All right. Lots of events.
Yeah, it is that time of year when there's lots of events. A couple of them going on today, all day today, starting at 9 o'clock, in other words, 3 minutes from now. Moving Planet, a national climate change action and series of events, getting people to talk about alternative modes of transportation. Moving Planet Seattle will be happening all day today at Lake Union Park. Workshops will be starting at 10 o'clock this morning at the China Harbor Restaurant off of Westlake, so go and check that out. Also, 3 o'clock today, down our friends in Lakewood at Coffee Strong, JBLM, that's the joint base of Lewis and McCord, on the brink, an event talking about suicides on the base and what the Army and Air Force can do to support families who've lost loved ones to the stress of service. So that's at Coffee Strong at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Tomorrow from 11 to 5, Sustainable Ballard will be having its festival at Ballard Commons Park. Wednesday the 28th, 7 o'clock, there will be a free school board candidates debate at Town Hall. So check that out for school board candidates. And then for city and county candidates, there will be a candidate forum on police accountability on Thursday, September 29th. That'll be from 6 to 9 o'clock at the New Holly Gathering Hall in South Seattle at 7054 32nd Avenue South.
Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State does local and national news and opinion and comics and so forth. I've been posting a lot more lately, just because I'm doing more national writing now. So go and check it out, www.eatthestate.org.